It's Central Time. I'm Rob Parrott. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, teenage girls in Wisconsin are seeing a much higher rate of mental health problems than teen boys are. That's according to a new report from the state's Office of Children's Mental Health. A psychologist tells us what's driving that trend and how to help. First, the huge amount of false information on the internet can make it hard to separate fact from fiction. But that false information doesn't show up accidentally. Our next guest says disinformation is created and spread intentionally on topics ranging from tobacco to climate change to the 2020 election. In his new book, he says disinformation is a threat to democracy, but there are ways to fight back. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been confused, overwhelmed maybe by conflicting information you've seen on the internet? How do you try to sort out fact from fiction? Where do you turn for trusted information? Do you have arguments with maybe friends or loved ones or coworkers who seem to have embraced some form of disinformation? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can email ideas@wpr.org. Lee McIntyre is the author of the new book On Disinformation, How to Fight for Truth and Protect Democracy, which just came out yesterday. Lee, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me on.
It can seem sometimes, Lee, like, well, we have this social media ecosystem and bad information floats out of somewhere and then it catches on, it spreads. One main point you make in your book is most of what we see when it comes to disinformation is hatched and spread deliberately. Could you talk about that?
Yes, I think you put your finger on the most important issue. Misinformation is a mistake or an accident. It's when you believe something false, but there's no intention behind it. It's just something that you heard and maybe it was mistaken. Disinformation is a lie. Disinformation is when someone spreads a falsehood intentionally because it serves their interest. Sometimes that's economic or political or ideological. But the idea with disinformation is that there's someone behind it and they're creating it and amplifying it for a reason.
One original source for modern disinformation you look at in the book is the tobacco industry. What did we see there that served in some ways as a model for what has exploded today in the disinformation world?
Yeah, modern science denial really started on December 15th, 1953, when the heads of the largest U.S. tobacco companies came together for a meeting at the Plaza Hotel in New York City, and they hired a public relations expert to come in and speak to them to advise them about a forthcoming study that showed a link between smoking and lung cancer. And his advice was fight the science. And he didn't mean fight it scientifically. He meant fight it through public relations, take out full page ads in American newspapers, come up with a precursor to the American Tobacco Institute, and try to lobby journalists and editors to, you know, quote, tell the other side of the story. And it really, it worked. For the next 40 years, the cigarette companies were able to deny, or at least to create doubt where there was none, in over whether smoking caused lung cancer, and continue to sell their cigarettes.
You've traced over the years other kinds of scientific denial and how they followed that model. Now you're seeing it jump more and more in the United States into the political world. How did it make that jump?
That was what was so scary to me, because a few years back, some cognitive scientists found that all science deniers reasoned the same way, whether it was about tobacco or climate change or flat earth or anything. They all followed the same blueprint, really the tobacco strategy that started as I've described. And then I started to see that this was happening not just for scientific topics, but other topics. And I call that reality denial. Whether the 2020 election was stolen, what happened on January 6th. I mean, you started to see that same toxic pattern of reasoning happening, not just about science, but about everyday reality, which means that we were becoming polarized about more and more factual issues. And that's what really motivated me to write the new book.
To recognize this kind of disinformation, you have a five-step list coming from the cognitive scientists you mentioned of the methods used in denial and disinformation. Can you run us through those?
Yeah, this was original work due to Mark and Chris Hufnagel, later developed by some others. But the idea is that this is the roadmap, if you will. All science deniers cherry-pick evidence. They believe in conspiracy theories. They engage in illogical reasoning. They rely on fake experts, and they believe that the other side has to be perfect or, say, offer proof in order to be credible. And when you think of those five steps and you just run through in your mind anytime somebody is talking about, you know, why they think that the vaccines have the COVID vaccines have microchips in them, or, you know, why there was a there were bamboo ballots in Arizona in 2020. It follows that same pattern.
And again, getting back to the origins of these stories, you mentioned the whole microchip vaccine. That comes from a specific place, you write, and that place is Russia.
Yeah, it's an amazing thing. How many people died during the pandemic because of that falsehood? But how many, almost nobody knows where that came from. And it came from a Russian troll farm in April 2020 in a publication called The Oriental Review. There was a story which said that any future vaccines developed in the West would have tracking microchips, courtesy of Bill Gates, who held patent 666 on this technology. The bottom of the story, it said, share on Facebook, share on Twitter, which millions of people did, because by the next month, by May 2020, 28% of the American public believed that there was something to that, and 44% of Republican voters believed that. Now, what they didn't know is that the Oriental Review was an English language propaganda arm of the SVR, which is military intelligence in Russia. It's the brand, the KGB busted up into different pieces, the GRU, the SVR, et cetera, and that was one of them.
Talking to Lee McIntyre about his new book, On Disinformation, How to Fight for Truth and Protect Democracy. You can join in with your thoughts, your experiences, maybe, or your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Lisa is with us in Madison. Lisa, hello.
Hi. I guess I'd just like the caller to address that a lot of we're seeing politicians in the U.S. grab onto this information, and really it's about creating distrust so that these people that believe this disinformation will turn to kind of their one source they believe they can trust, and how this distrust in science and medicine, media is just undermining democracy. And
Lisa, I got you. Your line's breaking up a little, but I think we get your point, Lee. The idea that politicians, she says, are sowing distrust to point toward a singular desired figurehead. What do you think?
Lisa has a better intuitive grasp on disinformation than most people, because I think that's exactly right. The point of disinformation is not just to get you to believe a falsehood. It's to get you to distrust people who don't also believe that same falsehood, and even to hate the people who don't believe the same falsehood. It's a kind of a tribal thing, you know, to build teams and to ultimately begin to think that the people who disagree with you are bad people who you can't trust. And at that point, you're almost gone, because then you can't revise your opinion based on facts, because you don't believe the facts, because you don't believe you don't trust the person who's sharing them. So that was terrific. Thank you.
Thanks for the call, Lisa. Lee, you spend a lot of the book applying this method of disinformation to analyze rejection of the outcome of the 2020 election and support for then President Donald Trump staying in office. Can you talk about that as, I think, the biggest case you're worried about of disinformation?
Yeah, this is the biggest case that I'm worried about, because what happened is I realized that people who were science deniers didn't just, you know, wake up one day, wondering whether there were microchips in their vaccines. That was disinformation that was fed to them to make them into deniers. And I think that you see this same pattern of disinformation creating a crowd of deniers happening with Donald Trump, with his big lie in 2020. He wanted to radicalize people around this falsehood because it served his interest. And you saw that culminate ultimately in January 6th, which was really the motivating event for me writing on disinformation. It was, I realized that all those years of lies, what did the Washington Post say, 30,000 lies over his presidency, culminated in that moment, because ultimately a disinformer lies because they want something. And what he wanted was political power, and the means to get it was through lying to the public to finally put them into action on his behalf.
We're talking to author Lee McIntyre about his new book, On Disinformation, How to Fight for Truth and Protect Democracy. Coming up, I'll ask what we can do to fight back against disinformation, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you talked to friends or relatives who you think were victims of disinformation? Did you try to change their mind? Did it work? What worked? What didn't? What questions do you have for our guest? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our conversation with author Lee McIntyre. His new book is called On Disinformation, How to Fight for Truth and Protect Democracy. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you run into a lot of misinformation, what you think might be disinformation, intentionally spread bad info online, in-person discussions? Which social media platforms do you think do better or worse at managing it? What do you want to see from the media? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Rich is with us in Two Rivers. Rich, hello.
Yeah, hey, thanks for having me on here. Yeah, I can't help but feel more and more pessimistic as this.
Oh, we're losing your line there, Rich. Rich, feeling pessimistic. We heard that much from him. Lee, amidst pessimism, and let's talk about what we can do about disinformation. You talk about person-to-person contact. How can someone talk to someone they know who is spreading or duped by disinformation?
It's so unfortunate. I wanted to hear what Rob was pessimistic about, but I think I know. Look, there are two things that I want to say about that. If you're confronted with somebody who is, been hearing disinformation and they have these wrong views about factual matters, be careful. I mean, that person is not your enemy. That person is a victim. And so there is a way to talk to them. I wrote an earlier book about it called How to Talk to a Science Denier. And the answer is that you talk to them with calm and patience and respect. Because remember that they don't trust you, but it is possible to get through, but the only possible way to get through is if you haven't broken the relationship. But now that's only one thing that you can do. And in the new book and on disinformation, what I've written about is the other end of that pipeline. Don't just look at the pipeline where the disinformation is coming out and people are believing it. Look at where it's coming from. Now, unfortunately, it's very hard to stop somebody who's creating disinformation from doing it because it's in their best interest to keep on doing it. But between those two pieces of the pipeline is amplification. I think that's the pinch point. That's where we can really crack down on disinformation. The best way to fight it is to keep it from flowing from the disinformer to the believer. And social media and partisan media, those are really the culprits that are making things worse and worse. It's why tobacco companies and their ilk don't need to take out full-page ads in newspapers anymore. They can just go on the internet and get that lie halfway around the world.
Thanks for calling in, Rich, at 800-642-1234. Sorry we lost that connection. Lee, for the mostly nonpartisan media or mainstream media, whatever we want to call it, you've been frustrated. It's clear in the book from how these issues of disinformation have been covered. What would you like to see change?
The number one thing I'd like to see changed is that every time someone's tempted to use the word misinformation, they should pause and think, is that really disinformation? Because if it's misinformation, then you're helpless, right? Then it's like a hurricane or a natural disaster, and you report on it as such, and people put their head down and they're scared and they feel there's nothing that they can do about it. But if it's disinformation, that means that it's a lie, which means there's a liar, which means there's something we can do to fight back, and that's empowering. One of the goals of disinformation is to make you feel powerless. But you're not powerless. There are many different ways to fight back, some of them grassroots ways that I outline in the book. And I think that the media should be amplifying that message, which is that there is something that you can do to fight back, not that, this is just all of, a big mystery and we don't know where this is coming from. We know exactly where this is coming from.
We heard around the 2020 election, Steve Bannon, on and off again, advisor to former President Trump, talking about, you know, it not mattering whether any particular piece of misinformation sticks, but flooding the zone with the S word. I can't say it. Thanks to the FCC. That idea that there's so much information out there and so many lies, and we get overwhelmed and stop being able to try to distinguish them. For somebody who's feeling that right now, and I think there are people out there, what do you suggest to them?
Hey, that's a Russian disinformation tactic. It's called the fire hose of lies or the fire hose of falsehood, and you see Putin use it all the time. People use that because they want to evade responsibility and accountability and blame, right? If you can just make up a whole cascade of lies, because it's almost impossible to, you know, debunk 10 lies in a row before you can get to the truth. It makes you cynical. It makes you demoralized. I think the best way to fight a technique like that is just to point out sometimes that they're contradictory lies, you know, to go right at the heart of it. One I heard about January 6th was, well, there was no violence on January 6th. Those were peaceful protesters. But then I also heard from some of the same people, well, the violence was all committed by Black Lives Matter or Antifa in disguise. How could both of those be true at the same time? I mean, there's a step three of that blueprint we talked about earlier, the illogical reasoning. So going at it that way, rather than taking on the factual content, but actually looking at the chain of reasoning and the motivation behind it, I think that can be a very effective way of fighting back against disinformation.
Talking to Lee McIntyre about his new book on disinformation, how to fight for truth and protect democracy. Let's go back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Mike is with us in Milwaukee. Mike, hi.
Yeah, hey guys.
What did you want to bring up, Mike?
I want to just kind of get the guest insight on. So I do a lot of like social media research for my job, and one thing that I've seen a lot lately is like Twitter, for instance. It seems like as a whole, it's trending toward becoming a disinformation source.
Mike, I gotcha. Thanks a lot for the call. Mike raising the social media platform formerly known as Twitter, now known as X, owned by Elon Musk. Do you see that as a particularly rich environment for disinformation, Lee?
Well, I do. And the reason I see it as a rich information for disinformation is because the disinformers do. I mean, formerly known as Twitter and Facebook are two of the most popular media through which the disinformers want to spread their disinformation. And the reason they choose them is because those platforms don't fight back hard enough. I know that they would protest. I know they would be upset at me for saying that. Mark Zuckerberg loves to point out how much money they spend on it, how many people they have fighting it. But if you look at what they value engagement, they value money, they value people using their platform, and they do that because of conflict. And so they, you know, maybe at some point are profiting from disinformation. They like this. When the social media companies want to fight something, they can do it. I give you the example of porn. When's the last time you saw porn on Facebook? And the answer is never. You never see that on Facebook. And that's because they fight it. And they don't just fight it through their algorithms or some other mechanical way. They have a human team that scrubs for it. It's got to be the worst job at Facebook. But they do that because they recognize it's a threat to their bottom line. They could do the same thing for disinformation about the vaccines, about the election. They choose not to. They put some resources toward it, but not up to the scale of the problem. And the issue here is the threat to democracy. Joan Donovan, one of the leading experts in the world on disinformation, said at a congressional hearing a few years back that the biggest problem that our nation faced was misinformation at scale, and the cost of doing nothing was democracy's end. Those are the stakes. The social media companies bear great responsibility in this, and I think that they have to fight back harder against disinformation. And we can help them to do that. And I outline how ordinary citizens can help in the book.
let's spend our last minute and a half or so, Lee, with some more suggestions. How, if somebody's listening, says, yes, I would like to help fight disinformation, what are things they can do?
The primary thing you can do is to realize that we are actually in an information war, that this is not a mistake, this is not an accident. You can't win an information war without admitting that you're in one. Once you admit that you're in one, then you understand that you're a foot soldier, but there are other people in this and that you have some power. If you want to put pressure on your legislators, on people in Washington to do something about this, bring up the issue. I mean, they have been very poor at fighting disinformation, mostly because they've gotten caught up in this worry that that fighting disinformation is somehow censorship. It's not. Refusing to amplify somebody else's lie is not censorship. So, I mean, there could be, Congress could pass a regulation about transparency at the social media companies, not becoming fact checkers themselves, but having a board of experts where they, black out user data, and they look at the algorithms and they try to identify public harm before it happens. You can put pressure on the social media companies yourselves. Boy, do they have an interest in keeping their users happy. But all of those social media companies also have advertisers. You can write to Twitter and Facebook to complain. You can also write to their advertisers. You can say, I'm going to quit the platform and I'm going to quit using your product unless you do something more about disinformation. Wouldn't take that many thousand people to do that before the social media companies would get serious.
Lee, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks very much for having me. I enjoyed it.
That's Lee McIntyre, author of the new book On Disinformation, How to Fight for Truth and Protect Democracy. Coming up after the news, a UW-Milwaukee psychologist joins the show to explore why teen girls in Wisconsin face rising rates of mental health issues, that according to a new report from the state, and what we can do about it. You can join in if you have a story to tell yourself or a question. You can email right now, ideas@WPR.org. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we take a look at a backlash against AP African American Studies in some conservative states around the country. Now, people of all ages are facing mental health challenges at a rising rate, but new data shows that teenage girls in particular are struggling even more than their male counterparts. The Wisconsin Office of Children's Mental Health released a report this month showing that female high school students are experiencing depression and other mental health issues at twice the rate of boys the same age. 66% of young girls around the state report struggling with anxiety. 50% say they feel sad and hopeless nearly every day. The CDC reports similar problems at the national level. It's all leaving parents, caregivers, teachers, and peers concerned about the well-being of this vulnerable group and the impact this could have as they develop into adulthood. We're checking in now on what's driving these issues for teen girls in particular and what we could do to support them. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Why do you think teen girls are suffering more mental health issues than boys? What, if anything, do you think needs to change? If you're the parent of a teen girl or a teen yourself, or you work with them in schools, love to hear what you're seeing. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Stacey Nye is a clinical professor of psychology at UW-Milwaukee. She's the director of the UW-Milwaukee Psychology Clinic and has her own private practice in Mequon called Nye Psychotherapy. Stacey, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for having me.
When you see things like this statewide report, like these CDC numbers, does this surprise you at how bad things appear to be getting for teen girls?
No, unfortunately, it does not surprise me. I've seen this in my own practice.
What do you think is driving these trends, these higher reports of things like anxiety and depression for teen girls over the last few years?
Well, I think that teen girls, everyone suffered during the pandemic. not just with their physical health, but with their mental health. So being isolated, you know, being in quarantine, not having your usual routine was really hard on most people, but particularly on teen girls, it had a really negative effect.
What is it for teen girls in particular? Are there factors out there you see like this might affect them more than say teen boys?
Sure. Well, you know, girls are really socialized and accustomed to having a greater level of emotional intimacy and support within their peer relationships. And all of those things were disrupted during, you know, the pandemic because they were stuck at home. They maybe didn't have the kind of privacy that they were used to normally. They didn't see their friends every day. They didn't have the same, you know, access to their routine. And then they spent, you know, a good part of their time on social media. And social media is one of the, you know, is a big culprit in the rise of depression and anxiety and eating disorders and body image issues and self-harm and suicidal ideation. So, you know, the evil social media.
Yeah, the report from the Office of Children's Mental Health here in the state pointed to a couple things you just mentioned, body image and self-esteem as one of the many potential factors causing this problem. And this is an issue I know you work on a lot in your own career. Can you talk about why that's been challenging for teen girls for a long time now, nowadays in particular?
So, you know, teen girls, you know, during adolescence, it's a time when we are already trying to formulate our identity and, you know, we are trying to fit in with, you know, a peer group and things like that. So, you know, girls are already vulnerable at that age. You know, all their development is different from their peers and it's a very chaotic time. So then when they're on social media a lot, there's so much comparison. There's so much access. Like girls have always compared themselves to celebrities, but in the past, you know, girls had to turn on the TV or, you know, go buy the magazine at Walgreens before they could see those things. But now it's constant access, constant comparing, and they can follow anyone and they can get a lot of not only, you know, like bad information, misinformation. And that's just the tip of the iceberg, you know, all of the social comparison that's done on social media.
We are talking to Stacy Nye, clinical professor of psychology at UW-Milwaukee, looking at a new statewide report finding high levels of mental health concerns for teen girls in the state, much more than, say, teen boys, problems increasing over time as well. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you have a question for our guest, maybe an experience of your own or in your family that you're willing to share, join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Stacy, how much does it worry you if we're seeing more and more girls dealing with anxiety, with depression as they grow into adulthood? What kind of impact can that have?
You know, it can potentially have a negative impact because they're learning now some maybe coping skills that aren't very helpful. And if they don't unlearn some of those negative coping skills like self-harm or maybe turning to drugs or alcohol, then they might very well take that into college when there's a lot less oversight on them. And that can, you know, have a continuing negative effect through college and adulthood. So hopefully someone sees that they're not doing well and can get them into some therapy.
Let's talk about parents for a moment. Now, I'm a parent. My girls are 20 now, young women, I guess, at this point. But I'm trying to imagine, you know, that conversation. How do you start this? How's your mental health? Or are you feeling anxiety? That's not necessarily something that's going to elicit a helpful answer from a teen girl. How can parents start that conversation, though?
It's so hard because, you know, teenagers don't typically tell their parents when they're having a hard time. Maybe they are afraid parents are going to overreact or something, but I would say one thing to do would be to look for warning signs. You know, is your teenager spending more time in their room than usual? They might already be spending a lot of time in their room, but have they become more isolated or spending less time with their friends? Are they moping around the house? You know, are they having, you know, anxiety attacks in your presence? Are you seeing scars, you know, from maybe self-injury? Sometimes friends will approach parents. We're worried about, you know, so-and-so, maybe you can ask. I mean, things have to be pretty bad for a friend to do that, but, you know, and I would also say changes in eating patterns or significant weight loss or significant weight gain might also be warning signs of something happening.
And then if a parent spots those maybe red flags, how do we reach out?
I would say in the calmest, most non-judgmental way possible. So approaching your child with, I'm worried about you. This is what I've noticed, A, B, C, and D things happening. Can we talk about it? If they say no, I would say, would you like to talk to someone else about it? So don't be, you know, insulted if your child doesn't want to talk to you about it. Please offer a professional or a school counselor or a family friend, you know, that the child likes, you know, and we're talking about teens here, but, you know, an adult family friend, maybe that they get along, an aunt or an uncle, someone, it doesn't have to be you, but get them, you know, see if you can get them talking to someone.
You are a professional. If you were talking to a teen girl in this situation, says, yeah, I'm feeling, you know, however they say it, more anxiety than I used to. I'm feeling these things that are showing up in this survey. I know every person's going to be different. The answer might be different for every kid. But what are some of your starting points in working with someone?
You mean as the professional?
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I'm gathering a lot of information, looking for triggers, looking for things that are happening in someone's life that are contributing to their stress level. You know, are they trying to get straight A's? Are they trying to lose weight so they can look perfect? Are they trying to, you know, just fit in with their friends? Is there loss? Has there been violence or sexual assault? Sometimes those are triggers to, often, I mean, that would be a trigger to depression or increased anxiety. And once I'm able to get that information about what's been going on, then I try to help them cope better. We don't teach coping skills in school. I mean, I think more now there's some mindfulness classes, but then I'm helping, you know, young people cope better. You know, I'm helping them with their self-esteem, have more realistic ideals and goals. Challenging negative thinking, teaching them maybe some mindfulness skills so they can relax and calm down, maybe helping them set boundaries, helping them deal with intense emotions. So there's lots of different things that might happen in my office.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Don is with us in Milwaukee. Don, hi.
Hi, Rob. Thank you. Excellent subject matter. Back in the year 1986, the Milwaukee County hired me to work on their crisis intervention team. I says, you got me, I'm volunteer, but I don't want any pay or any money. I says, you can't put a price tag on a person's life. But I have gone into a lot of closer meetings of people that actually did take their life. And the sure sign is when a person tells their best friend or family member or coworker that maybe life is better with me not being here, all of a sudden, the person that had closed their meeting crying about their friend or loved one took their life. I mean, it's always the first sign when somebody just mentions or breathes that statement, saying, maybe I should just, you know, blah, 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 just be gone. And I've seen that in hundreds, 200-300 different issues that he would tell somebody that one time.
Don, thanks a lot for sharing your experience there. And Stacy, looking back to this state report now, Don raises the concern about suicide. Now, 1 in 4 girls in this report considered suicide. 1 in 5 made a plan for it. 1 in 10 attempted. Very serious problem. Alarmingly high numbers as I'm reading them. What do we do with that? How do we start to prevent that?
I think we need to really increase our screening measures. I know that when you go to the doctor's office now, they ask you about that. I think that should be happening in schools with coaches, you know, very brief, you know, like screenings. You just simply ask, have you had any thoughts about hurting yourself or ending your life? And, you know, that's like an intense question, right? And you have to, you know, maybe have a relationship already established with someone, but But you never know. Someone might say, well, actually, yes, I have thought about that. And people are afraid to ask that question. People think, well, I don't want to give someone the idea of suicide. But I'm telling you right now, you can't give someone the idea that they haven't thought of already. Just asking someone will not make someone take their life. There's many more factors involved in that. So you're better off asking than not asking.
Thanks a lot for that call, Don. Good time to mention the Suicide and Crisis Lifeline number. That's 988. Again, 988. We're talking to UW-Milwaukee clinical psychology professor Stacy Nye about mental health and teenage girls in Wisconsin. They're reporting higher rates of depression, anxiety, and other issues over time and compared to teenage boys. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have thoughts of the causes behind this? Do you see ways we can better support teen girls? Do you have an experience you'd be willing to share in your own life or maybe a family member or someone at your school? You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Stacy Nye. She's a clinical professor of psychology and director of the psychology clinic at UW-Milwaukee. With us today for a look at a new report highlighting record high rates of mental health issues among teenage girls in Wisconsin. Anxiety, depression, and more. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think is causing the most harm to the mental health of teenage girls? What solutions do you have in mind? Do you have questions for our guest? Do you have an experience you're willing to share? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Stacy, anecdotally, one trend I've noticed over my lifetime is where, you know, mental health was something you very much didn't talk about publicly. It seems like there's a trend for people to be willing to share their stories more and more. One, are you seeing that too? And two, if so, is that a good thing?
I think it's definitely a good thing. I do think there's still a stigma against mental health issues. Talking about mental health, seeing therapists, a lot of people still feel a lot of shame around that or feel that they should be able to handle things themselves. But I think that, you know, like celebrities talking about their own mental health struggles, I think is helpful and can often make it okay for other people to come forward and get some help.
I want to come back to something you mentioned earlier. We were talking about body image for teen girls and mentioning the problems, especially in the world of social media, where there's always somebody to compare yourself to on your phone anytime. What can we do about that? What recommendations do you have to promote, satisfaction with our body image?
Well, I'm glad you asked because I did want to get back to something that I wanted to encourage parents to do, which is take a weight neutral approach to their own health and the health of their family. I think, you know, our kids learn by modeling. And even if we don't tell our kids, you're fat, you should go on a diet. If we're calling ourselves fat, if we're dieting, if we're trying to lose weight, you know, kids see that and they are very impressionable. Now, that doesn't mean that we don't all have health issues that we need to address, but the focus should be on health and a whole body approach to health, not on weight specifically, you know. So our nutrition, our exercise, our sleep, you know, our study habits, all of that contributes to how healthy we are. And so not focusing on the way we look, like, well, you're fat and you should lose weight, you know, that really can have a terribly negative effect on teens, girls and boys.
Supposing we're really good at that as parents, but then out there in pop culture, you know, there's on social media and magazines, there's a cellulite watch for celebrities and like all sorts of negative messages. Are there ways we can positively counter that or at least give some media literacy to help counter that?
Absolutely. So challenging media messages and, you know, social media messages and how, you know, people present themselves on social media in the best positive light. There's still things like Photoshop and filters and everything. So who knows what people really look like. But definitely media literacy is so important. And just like caution around social media in general is so important. So I'm not suggesting that everyone takes their, you know, kids' phones away, because that wouldn't help either. But, you know, really like sitting down with your kids and saying, let's look at some of these things. Let's talk it through, you know, what's realistic, what's not, things like that.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Jean is with us in Stevens Point. Jean, hi.
Hi, I have a question regarding a 13-year-old granddaughter and social media. And I'm really concerned about what it is that she's seen on there and the algorithms that are being presented to her. Like you've said about depression, weight loss, trying to be perfect, trying to look older, be older than she is. I'm just really uncomfortable with how much they're exposed to, and the parental controls that are out there really aren't enough to keep these kids safe. And how do you convince a young girl that that's the truth when all of her friends are using social media as you so hear it? It's just really hard to counteract that. I know you said sit down with them, go through it together, but these kids do spend a lot of time on their phones unsupervised also.
Jean, thanks a lot for the call. I know you are not alone in dealing with this situation. Stacey, any further thoughts for Jean?
I mean, I think she has every right to feel concerned about that. And, you know, this is, again, sitting down, having conversations. Maybe even, you know, if this is your granddaughter, she might be like, oh, grandma, you don't know what you're talking about. You know, having like older siblings maybe can also help and be influential, or college students, you know, someone who they might look up to and think, oh, they're not so far off from my experience. They maybe know more about, you know, what I'm talking about. And, you know, I promise you that even if they're all doing it, there's a level of discomfort that many people are feeling when they're on social media, whether it's comparison or receiving strange messages from people that have no business messaging them. If you can, in again, a calm and non-judgmental way, open up the conversation, let's talk about some of the things that are happening, then you might be able to get an in there and help them be able to decipher for themselves.
Thanks a lot for calling in, Jean. Appreciate it. Stacey, are there things that we can help preteens with to prepare them for some of the challenges that come with the teenage years?
I mean, I think it's very similar, right? You know, like trying to, you know, create an environment of, you know, a non-judgmental home, you know, focusing on health, and trying to help balance, you know, some of the things they're going to be facing, whether it's social media or school pressure or pressure from, you know, sports and things like that, you know, trying to keep an open dialogue as much as possible.
And I wonder, finally, Stacey, about the idea of, you know, when a teen girl is going through a tough time with anxiety or depression, ways to communicate hope that things can and will get better without sounding dismissive, like, oh, this is just a phase, or, you know, something unhelpful like that. Is there a positive way to point toward light at the end of the tunnel there?
Yeah, I think if parents have their own personal example, without getting into too much, you know, detail, talking about, I struggled with that when I was your age, or when I was older or younger, and, you know, I got some help, or I talked to someone, or someone reached out to me, and I'm doing much better now. I'm happier because of it. So I think we can definitely, you know, inspire hope in our kids.
And briefly, Stacey, with this new statewide report with numbers out from the CDC, are you hopeful that people are going to look at this as a problem we need to tackle for teen girls?
I hope so, because we definitely need increased funding for mental health and access for everyone for mental health treatment, affordable mental health treatment.
Stacey, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
We've been talking to Stacey Nye, clinical professor of psychology at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. She's also director of the UW-Milwaukee Psychology Clinic and has her own private practice in Mequon called Nye Psychotherapy. She was with us today to talk about some of the mental health challenges facing teenage girls in Wisconsin and around the country. A reminder, the number for the Suicide and Mental Health Crisis Hotline is 988. Again, that's 988, and you can do that with a call or by texting. Again, the Suicide and Crisis Hotline number, 988. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, the Milwaukee Brewers are in first place late in the season. Find out what's been going right and what it would take for a strong playoff run. And you can get started right now. If you have been watching closely, a longtime fan watching every detail, or you're a fair weather fan trying to jump on the bandwagon in time for the playoffs, I won't judge. Email ideas@WPR.org. Then join the conversation. That's tomorrow morning at 7:30 here on the Ideas Network. If I says to you, tell me two things about giraffes. Number one, you probably say long necks. They got those long necks. Number two, the spots. Technically, the reticulations, the brown patches surrounded by those whitish lines. But here comes a twist. A baby giraffe was born a few weeks back at a Tennessee zoo without the spots. As reported by CNN, the baby giraffe made its public debut earlier this month at Bright's Zoo in Tennessee. The species has spots right in the name. They're called reticulated giraffes, but this young female giraffe is very unreticulated, solid brown, quite possibly the only one in the world. She doesn't have a name yet. You can vote online among four choices. The winning name will be announced on Labor Day weekend. The zoo operators hope the unreticulated giraffe can help draw attention to giraffe conservation efforts. Some people have called this giraffe spotless, but I've seen some pushback saying, hey, she's all spot, just one spot. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.